Welcome to We Are Libertarians. This week, my name is Joe Ruiz. I am filling in, apparently, for Chris Spangle, who is not here. I was supposed to be a guest on the show with Greg Lenz and Dan Peffers today. We came into Chris's apartment where the podcast is normally recorded, and Chris was not there. But the door was open, and it looked like he maybe had been there recently. We've still not been able to locate him, but we found a really odd recording. And we're just going to go ahead and play that for you right now so you can get a feel for what we're hearing. And then maybe you can speculate, because your guess is going to be as good as ours as to where Chris Spangle currently is.
Attention, we are libertarian. We have your leader. Now, some of you might be thinking, what's that all about, eh? And the answer is...
Hey, Bob, can I borrow a toonie? It's cold and I want to score a double-double.
Rick, be quiet, eh? I'm trying to record our ransom note.
I know. Gonna be awesome, but seriously, eh? The toonie.
Okay. Here, no. Take two. See if you can get me one of them matrimonial cakes, eh?
We still gonna have enough for the 2-4?
We don't need a 2-4. We just need enough to fill a Mickey.
Right. Okay. Back to the ransom, then.
Right. As I was saying about your leader, Chris Spangle, too long we've sat around the rink hearing stories about We Are Libertarians and their hatred of our people. You want to talk about how we all live on the border and we're just waiting to invade? Well, there, we did it. Rick and I came right kitty corner to your little state of Indiana and took them. And if you want them back, all you have to do is apologize and let your listeners know that Canada is the greatest. Until then, let's see how your little show goes without them, eh?
All right. Again, this is Joe Ruiz. Greg, what do you think is going on?
You know, I'm quite concerned. There was a ransom note, and I'm a little worried. I feel, you know, I know he did, quite frankly, leave the Self-Advocates for Growth, so I'm a little nervous about the liberty movement in the United States. What about you, Dan?
I think he might have been taken hostage, and now he's working in the syrup mines of Scandinavia, you know,
or Saskatchewan. I mean, do you guys think this is he playing a joke on us right now, or do you think this is something we should really be worried about? Because he wouldn't just walk out of his apartment with the door open the way that he did.
Yeah, especially because he has pets, you know? I mean, are mittens and whatever the
muffins,
other...
Mittens and muffins? They are safely at? In a shelter, triumphantly awaiting
okay.
his
so
return.
He might not be back for a while. Is what you're saying.
I don't know. So when people quit liberty, they tend to quit forever.
Oh, man. Quit at everything. Liberty is life, and when you quit at liberty, you know.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I am a little bit worried. And I guess Chris would probably want us to just go ahead and go on with the show as usual. I'll host. Greg?
A little presumptuous of a guest, don't you think?
To host? Well, here's the thing is I usually host the Culture and Arts podcast, so I have a little bit of hosting experience behind me. Here's the thing. Last week, Spangle prefaced the episode, which he titled The Problem with Anarchy, by pointing out that Peppers and Maya were purposely left off the show so that those present, which was Greg and Gina, could balance out the recent anarchist bent that seemed to be happening on We Are Libertarians. And after listening to the show, Peppers wanted an opportunity to respond, and today he's going to get that opportunity. So, Peppers, why don't you just dive right into your rebuttal?
Well, I would have to say that I don't have to give my rebuttal. It's just I should give my rebuttal. I can't deprive our listeners of the rebuttal. But, I mean, ultimately, we come across the same questions over and over again, and it's pretty frustrating because, I mean, these questions that do get asked are very important. Things like, how do two people who are fundamentally opposed on a very important issue, such as in a car accident, you need to figure out a way on how people are going to get paid for when their property is damaged. Even unexpectedly, even without malice, you know. Sometimes there is malice, sometimes there's not, and in both circumstances, we need to. This is a very big problem to solve. And the thing is, people don't often realize that when they're asking what the anarcho-capitalist solution is, they're really asking for a much broader question. I mean, we've got a very complex legal code. Whenever we run into what do we do about crime, what do we do about property damage, et cetera, we've got this huge legal system, and basically the question of how is anarcho-capitalist justice supposed to work And you're basically saying, in the next 10 minutes, how would you explain how you would replace, you know, tens of thousands of pages of legal code?
You mean you can't go and just do it overnight?
The thing about societal problems is they tend to persist no matter what economic system you have. The big thing about ANCAPs is that we believe that these things can be sorted out by individuals rather than by government. That this is, that society is a bottom up rather than a top down process.
What were the major, like, the specific issues? Because we had a lot of people who listen writing in to We Are Libertarians on Facebook, sending Spangle emails, sending us emails on the website, and they were upset with Gina's position that she took last week. And, you know, We Are Libertarians is supposed to be about the spectrum from the Creighton Harringtons all the way down to the Maya Axtons, or, you know, if you want to say up, down, either way, I guess it's reversible. But what is your extremes. Specific issue?
My specific issue with what was said, I'm having a little problem remembering a lot of the specifics of what was said. But basically, Gina seemed to think that a society without government is a cruel society, that a society without government is a society where people spend their time just taking advantage of each other and planning on ways to take advantage of each other and making sure you take advantage of each other before someone takes advantage of you. And the thing is, if that is true, if that is what we should expect from our fellow man, then we're simply screwed as a society. There is no society that can emerge from people who are fundamentally evil, because any construct of a group of fundamentally evil people will be a fundamentally unjust society. It'll be something that falls apart, you know? The reason why we are capable of forming a society is because most of the time we're not trying to screw each other over. We're not trying to steal from each other. And we understand, even people who are sociopaths understand that violence is harmful and in the long run it would cause a societal breakdown.
The big thing with Gina,
yeah,
is what she was afraid to admit was that competition, that was the biggest issue I had, that competition in public services is a bad thing. She wouldn't admit that by having multiple public utility providers, that the level of service would go up because people would be competing for dollars. When that happened, she wanted to blame corporations. When we explained that corporations, in fact, allowed corporations to even exist, her instinct, instead of blaming government, was still to, in fact, see the government as a backbone or guarantee against or an advocate for the people, as opposed to the very reason that corporations are allowed to take advantage of individuals, and they create these natural monopolies. And that was my big concern. That's why I tried to help her think it through. Her example was this water purification system that essentially isn't affordable. It's not affordable. And so I said, well, if let's say...
She mentioned something about UV.
Yep, it's a UV water filtration system, yeah, for public utility,
yeah,
companies.
Yeah, I've heard of similar ways of sterilizing large amounts of water, but I do think that... I mean, UV light is something that's very energetic. It's more energetic than visible light, so only slightly more. So if you were to take, like... It'd be like running a black light all the time, you know?
Yeah.
Those get really hot. They run up your electric bill if you keep them on all the time. And if you've got to keep enough on to process, you know, 20,000 gallons of water, you know, that's going to be a significant drag.
I understand that. But the point is, it was that the government is the culprit. The government is what allows the corporations, the public monopolies, to exist and exploit the consumer and restrict choice. Any market you're in, the more competitors there are, the more variety of choices you have, and the lower the price becomes. Because the market enforces people to use resources efficiently. That's just a basic law of economics. And all price is a illustration of how efficiently you have used the resources you have available. And if you are able to, you make a profit. If you are not able to, you make a loss and go out of business. What happens is the government subsidizes public utilities. They offer a crappy level of service because they don't have competition to make them improve. And on top of that, they are subsidized by the federal government, which allows them to exploit the consumer. Mm-hmm. It's really, uh-huh. And that's what I wanted her to grasp. But when you look at it as fairness, like she does, she's very much a left libertarian. That is a pretty, it's a foundational shift, and those types of things don't happen overnight. So I felt a lot of the criticism was probably unwarranted because she's, the more she learns and digs in, she's going to reach that point.
Well, yeah, that's what I always say, that everyone I meet is a future anarcho-capitalist.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, and well, the big thing is that there are people who are generally pro-government who will say, out of fairness, we need to have these safety nets, we need to have some sort of organization in place that can help people out, and somehow private charity is not going to be able to drum up the resources. But the thing that most people refuse to remember who do subscribe to these ideas is that government is no different from any other organization other than the fact that they have a monopoly of force.
Yeah.
And so that the only thing that the government can do that a private company cannot do is force you to hand them money, is force you to do things. And so that when it comes to things like charity and safety nets and providing utility, the thing is, you're saying that the only way that mankind can provide for itself is if you have guns making people do the bare necessities of life. But the thing is, people tend to take care of the bare necessities of a life for themselves, given the opportunity, if they're allowed to keep the fruit of their labor.
And that was a point Gina had contention with. We got into a little bit of a discussion about levels of responsibility, how much responsibility you have, and at a certain point, when you have so much responsibility and are, I mean, even...
Yeah, she had the whole, there are some people with a lot of responsibility who are actually very unresponsible, and I do agree that there are people like that, but, I mean, bottom line is, the only person who has to live your life is you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, therefore, all the responsibility, maybe things aren't your, maybe bad things happen to you, but you're the only one who has to live with the consequences of your own life. So even if the circumstances are unfair, there's really not much that can be done if you don't, you know, take the initiative to try to be the commander of your own destiny.
Yeah.
So, Greg, was there any conversation between you and Gina after the podcast ended? I know you guys kind of got out of there quickly, but as far as, do you feel like she came into a better understanding of how you were trying to portray the government as the culprit?
I feel like with her, she is so, due to her life experiences and what she, like, she worked in the corporate world for quite some time. And while she was working there, she worked for big, big, big defense. And mm-hmm. So she saw a lot of incredible corruption and exploitation of the American consumer. But what she didn't grasp and what she never got to the level of understanding was that it was the government that allowed that defense contractor to, in fact, exploit the taxpayer.
Oh, yeah, that's why I'm an anti-war veteran.
And so her instinct is to blame the corporation, and all that is an element of, I've talked about it before, like getting to the third level. Like, okay, you know, how did this happen? And you just have to dig, and I think anytime you do, you're going to find out that the government, in nearly every exploitative situation in American life or US, or global life, it is in fact the government that allows it. They give license. They are the licensee of exploitation.
And that's the nature of the corporation. There was one thing that Greg said at the last podcast that I found very interesting was that the whole concept of an LLC was asset protection for a shipping company barons.
Yep, the East India Trading Company.
The East India Trading Company specifically. That sounds like it'd be very helpful to drum up support, because that means you can get people to pay for franchising fees and not have to put their own money on the line. Well, they put their own money on the line, but they won't have to put their personal assets on the line if the ship sinks or whatever. And Yeah, that does look like a fair bit of protectionism. But the thing is, I got to bring up something Walter Block told me before, and that was that corporations actually can exist within a contract framework rather than a completely legal framework. The idea that of limited liability means that if you do business with somebody who is a little limited liability company, you are doing business with them under the assumption that their assets are not for grabs. So, I mean, in a way, LLC it can be protectionism. The fact that the government holds the monopoly on all LLC related or all asset protection related companies, or all asset protection related to companies, if it was handled by contracts, I think it would definitely be a better system, more equitable.
I agree completely. And what the biggest effect it has, and I talked about this a bit, and I wanted to make sure that people understand what I was talking about, was when you offer that protection to the owners and to the shareholders, all you're really doing is distorting incentives.
Well, you're not offering that to the shareholders. You're offering that protection to yourself.
Yeah.
The shareholders are the ones who are going to have their assets seized.
Well, sometimes, like for instance, if you're a majority founder, right? You're going to be protected because you're a shareholder, and in the event that there is a bankruptcy or there is a major lawsuit.
Oh, that's more of a difference between preferred stock and common stock.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, regardless, it creates a perverse incentive. If I want to do business with Peppers,
mm-hmm.
and I know that if I can essentially protect any of my existing assets by not making them part of the deal, instead of saying, Dan, listen, I'll tell you what, I'm going to put up the title on my car if this thing goes bad. If I can say, Dan, I'll do this for you, but I don't have anything that I can actually offer as collateral. I have zero, absolutely, I mean, I have zero down, or my upside's unlimited, and my downside is limited. So mm-hmm. the incentive becomes to do as many deals, like on Wall Street, what happens over and over, that have unlimited upside, and you know that you have hedged risk on the downside.
Mm-hmm.
If you remove that and you make everyone have to put their actual collateral up, that goes away.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes it from short-term entrance into the market trying to make a quick buck to an entire time frame of long-term economic investment and deal making.
When money's cheap and easy, and then the big thing you do is you make everybody has the incentive to take as wild a risk as possible. Because it's not their money they're gambling away, but it is their profits.
Exactly, exactly. Now, Joe, I was going to ask you, because you, I'd say on the political spectrum, you're definitely a libertarian, but you would be a minarchist or maybe a little bit more. Is that correct?
That is definitely where I started, excuse me. And when I ran for office in 2012, that is definitely where I was at. You know, the more we talk to people like Walter Block, and Jeffrey Tucker and some of the other people we've been able to secure on the program and on the show report also back when we were doing that, is the more I become, I guess, more of an anarcho-capitalist. So I've had kind of a transition myself, or a little bit of an awakening, where I've decided to do less and less through the channels that the government, I guess, provides for us and working within the system, and more just taking what little freedoms I can for myself and trying to find out how I can be free around the government rather than through the government.
Okay, and what did you think of the last show? What were your topics you wish we would have covered better, or your criticisms or rebuttals?
If I can be perfectly frank, I don't know that there's any specific issue where I thought to myself, you know, I wish they would cover this, I wish they would cover this. I was one of the people who, I know you said that people were wrong for the criticisms of Gina, but I was definitely in the camp of, wow, I can't believe this is the same girl that we've had on this program for the last year. And I love Gina, and I hope she's back many more times. She's obviously part of Wall, but I was surprised at her and her position on, you know, the what she seemed to reject, free market economics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the two of you have a fairly similar background as far as what side of the political spectrum you hail from, right?
We both come from the left. We both, you know, became what we now consider or call ourselves libertarians until the last episode when she said at one point that she wasn't, I think. Now, you know, like I said, the more I read into it, the more I listen to certain people talk and give answers to certain questions, and the more I kind of dig in, the more maybe I even shed that or at least move to the more anarcho-capitalist side of that word.
Yeah, that's what I love about anarcho-capitalism is the more familiar you are with the concepts, the easier it is to understand it, and the more people tend to gravitate towards that philosophy.
Well, my favorite thing about it, and I think this is something that I've taken from Jeffrey Tucker, you know, because he is somewhat contagious in the way that he presents ideas.
Oh, contagious is optimism.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, when you're a libertarian, I was a libertarian party libertarian, and so I was actually working to pursue the growth of a third party. And there's a lot of things stacked up against having the libertarian party when the two major parties are trying to keep you shut out, right? And that's, you know, money. There's all sorts of stuff.
Third party is a revolution the hard way.
Yes, it's easy to be negative when you're in that position. It feels like you don't get a lot done. It feels like things are always in slow motion. Not that I disagree with what those guys are trying to do, but you know what I've come to realize is we can look at government just a little bit of a different way. We can build a commentary within ourselves, and we can quit being negative Nancys and saying government shouldn't be a part of that. Government shouldn't be a part of that. Government shouldn't be a part of that. Because when you talk like that, people who are invested in the ideas of government, whether it be Republican or Democrat, they're looking for solutions. And whenever the word solution is mentioned, they want a government solution or something like that. Whereas we now, as libertarians or as anarcho-capitalists, we can be more of an observer. We can take a role and just almost act as if government is passé. We can see things like marijuana legislation becoming legal in Colorado and, you know, it being discussed in other states. We can see same-sex marriage and some things like that where the Libertarian Party and other small-L libertarians have kind of advocated for that in a sense. That stuff is happening, and it's not because some great politician is out there making and implementing all these really great policies. It's because those are the ideas that are being awakened and pursued by the general public with or without it. So I think that as a culture, we're changing and we're going to start coming around to some of those more libertarian ideas. So when something is done, like some of the things we're going to talk about later tonight with the FCC, it's one of those things where we can just look at it and say, oh, isn't that silly that the government's attempting to do that? They're obviously very panicked. They're in this position where they feel like they're on the losing side of these ideas and they're trying to strangle the life out of whatever control they can have left. And if we can look at it from that optimistic glasses half full kind of mentality, then I think the battle is really already won. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah. The problem with party politics is it's all about platform. It's just a policy checklist, policies you support, policies you don't. With libertarianism, it's a little difficult to try to convey what it is because people are used to a policy checklist, not a group of principles that you actually have to utilize these principles, apply them to the world around you, and actually come to a conclusion instead of just being told what to think.
And I think that's the hard part of politics, though, is it's coalition building. It's getting people to show up and vote and finding those people, finding candidates who identify and speak to those people, regardless of the principles of your party.
Oh, man. And trying to get people to vote, you got to do all sorts of things that then people hate you for.
Yeah, you can either buy them or you can protect their guns and try to put the Bible into the code law.
Well, this was from my YLS days when I was taking a lot of YLS classes from the Leadership Institute, and one of the tactics is whoever you've identified as a supporter, you call them every day until they tell you to stop calling, because anything after that is harassment. But I mean, you want to call them.
That's not called dating.
But you want to call them every day until election day, so they do not forget to vote for you when the time comes.
Yeah.
If they're annoyed at you, that's not going to change how they feel about abortion. You know.
So, in conclusion, to wrap up, did you feel that anarcho-capitalism or anarchy was misrepresented?
I do. anarcho-capitalism is always misrepresented because people assume that anarchy is a state of lawlessness, when that is nihilism. Nihilism is a state of lawlessness. Anarchy is a bottom-up process to law and order rather than the statist top-down process. But it's going to take a long time. I plan on... now I might be holding myself to a little much by saying this on the air, but I'm planning on trying to start out with a bunch of small articles about some basic anarchism concepts, just so people are familiarized with the basics, because they always want to jump into these difficult problems, but you, in order to be able to explain the difficult ones, you need to be able to you need to understand what the basics of anarcho-capitalism is.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we certainly hope that those articles are up on We Are Libertarians' website soon and that everybody has access to them so they can get a better vibe for you know, what Dan Peppers means when he talks about anarchy and anarcho-capitalism.
Oh, the first one should be up on Monday.
Excellent. Morning. Okay. Well, we're going to go ahead and bounce into Kiev, because this week, in the last week or so, it's been off the chain in Kiev. Greg, tell us a little bit about, I mean, how this all started and what's going on over there.
I'll tell you what's going on, and it's very much a bottom-up protest. It's very populist. It's funny. It's actually a little bit nationalistic in the way it's being brought about.
So how much like the Iron Curtain falling do these protests look?
It looks... It's funny. If they wanted to be a free and independent Ukraine, that would be one thing. That's not what they really want.
Oh.
What they want is to be a part of the European Union. That is what these supporters want. They think that if they are part of the European Union, they can be more independent. If they accept a deal with Russia and Vladimir Putin, once again, it's the start of the building of the Soviet Union again, and they're one of the satellite states.
So there's disagreement on whether they should throw in with Russia or the European Union?
There's one faction in particular, and I believe they're called Vector, and they are they're called far right. And whenever you hear that word far right, you start to think of Adolf Hitler and the National the National Socialist Party.
Yeah.
But they're not. What they are is they're very just purely nationalistic, but they're capitalist. They're not racist. They just are very prideful Ukrainians. They believe in... They're not totally different than the Tea Party, except they specialize in guerrilla warfare tactics. So they were in this area, the Maidan, which was supposed to be in Kiev, this park that was a bastion of freedom that the people controlled. They could do what they wanted. They would show government. They will protest, and they will make the decisions by the people and be proud. What happens is Vector comes in and they start saying, well, hey, if you guys get to the point, if this thing takes off and we build a following, we can teach you how to put up a fight like none other.
Hmm.
So I don't know how much you guys watched, but the images were, I mean, it looked like an absolute anarchist revolution. I mean, it was burning tires, people on tops of trucks burning, like V for Vendetta.
There you go, using the bad branding of anarchy.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Like that's kind of the image that people have in their heads.
Yeah, that's nihilism right there. That with burning tires and whatnot. That's chaos.
No,
especially since they're doing it in the pursuit of essentially more government.
Exactly.
To be a part of something bigger.
Anarchy is a political philosophy.
So should it be self-governance?
Well, what do you mean by self-governance?
That they are in control of their own destiny. The people of Ukraine will not be dictated to by a small sect of leaders who want to align with Russia.
I mean, I guess I'm not sure what you're asking.
Sorry, you know what I probably should have said is revolutionary. It looked like a revolutionary image. You know, it was very, enthusiastic. They were and that was my point. Was this far right crowd? The reason it took that turn, the reason the pictures and images, if you look at them, looked like out of a movie. They looked V for Vendetta or like the end of times. You know, like that's what it looked like. It's dark. It's burning. The people are standing, you know, on top of all kinds of
Something you'd expect from an Iron Curtain state.
It looked really cool. It was inspiring to me. Now, to the average individual, it probably scares them. They're probably like, who are these crazy anarchist protesters? And so I probably shouldn't have said it that way. It's definitely more of a grassroots political revolution. The thing that stinks for them, though, is it's half a dozen one way, half a dozen the other.
What do you mean?
If you go under Biden, if you take Russia's deal, and the real issue here is the EU trade agreement, the citizens and the followers of the opposition want to associate and join the EU. The people who are in charge were scheduled back in November to start joining the EU, and they backed out. The reason they backed out was that the Ukrainian government was having serious financial issues and terrible time meeting their debt obligations. What happened? Vladimir Putin, flush with gas that's flooding Europe, and he has just limitless funds nearly, comes in, says, hey, don't worry about it. We will finance your debt. On top of that, we will offer you cheap gas. Why don't we talk about maybe forming an agreement with us?
So this is the beginning of a NAFTA EU-like system.
So, and that's the thing, is do Ukrainians want to be more like Europe? And really all that is more of a socialist democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Or do they want to be more like the Russians, who are very nationalistic, but they tend to export Russia everywhere they go. But the downside is the European Union agreement cannot offer the financial incentives because Europe has no money.
Yeah, Europe squandered Germany's money.
And when you say Europe, what you really mean, what everyone really means, is Germany and then the United States backing that up.
Oh, that's the IMF.
Yeah, Greg, is it strictly the EU or are there some other things that these people are upset about? Because my understanding, and the current president, his name is Viktor Yanukovych, is that right?
And he was actually impeached and is resigning, he's supposed to resign. Essentially, he doesn't have any power anymore.
Well, because they seized it today, right?
Yep, they seized Kiev today.
And so Parliament has voted essentially to get rid of him. But he's saying that he's going to refuse to go. Is that correct?
Yes, he still believes he is the rightful leader. He is refusing to step down. Now, they have Kiev. Apparently, the police aren't even stopping the people from walking into Parliament. Into the presidential mansion, they're just walking right in and taking over the place.
Wow.
Jeez. But there, back in November when they were talking about the EU agreement that you were discussing, there was an opposition leader named, what was her name? It was a former prime minister.
Yep, she is actually a political prisoner named Tymoshenko.
Yulia Tymoshenko,
yep,
right?
Yulia Tymoshenko.
And they were trying to, because she was in jail at the time, and they were trying to put out a bill that would have her to make her able to leave the country. Is that right?
Correct.
And they were also upset on top of the EU thing falling out and being rejected by Yanukovych's cabinet, that they were also upset about her not being able to leave.
Correct. And she was just freed today. She is in hiding currently because she's definitely in danger. Quite frankly, probably by Russian special forces more than anyone. And she is very much a populist leader. The other really interesting thing is the second biggest and most, actually probably more than her, visible person in the opposition is the boxer Vitaly Klitschko. He actually, once he retired, he got into politics. He has a PhD. He's incredibly brilliant. And he is the face that works with Europe in negotiating the actual agreements by leading this party.
You know, wrestlers are popping up all over the place these days.
And he, I think, to my knowledge, he only had lost one match, and it was to Lennox Lewis, and it was a TKO.
Oh, so he's a boxer.
Yeah, he was the world heavyweight, undefeated champion. Undefeated world heavyweight champion. He had one technical knockout that was called because he had a 6-inch gash above his eye, and it ended up having to have 60 stitches.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, he's a stud, though. He is 6'6" and just scary as can be. But it's funny. He is kind of like the face for the rest of the world for this new Ukraine.
So right now the plan is to join the EU, but the protesters want to join...
The protesters want to join the EU.
The protesters want to join the EU, and Russia's coming in with a better financial package.
Let me ask you guys a question, because I think that, you know, from our perspective, it's easy. We can sit here in the U.S., we're in our chairs, and when we're talking about this, we're libertarians, and so we have this very far, very distant third-party perspective. But if you were in Kiev right now, if you were a Ukrainian citizen and you knew the history that Viktor Yanukovych has, because there's a lot of corruption in that administration and in the time that he's been a prominent political figure, you know, would you be anxious to jump into the EU and hope for better leadership as part of this bigger union? Or would you be looking for, I guess, an alternative?
Yeah, man, this is a tough question because, I mean, this is a major treaty. You can only sign one or the other. And as we see with every major treaty system, NATO, IMF, EU, NAFTA, United Nations is the biggest. You know, we see that they are designed to strip sovereignty from the smaller unit in order to give it to the bigger unit, such as the United Nations. Now, you know, you can't deny that the United Nations does not strip power from Congress.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
You cannot deny that, you know, because the United Nations can declare war against a country and, I mean,
send in the blue helmets.
Yeah, send in the blue helmets, and our troops are going over there whether Congress declares war or not. But the big thing is the devil you know versus the devil you don't,
and right.
And you're trying to choose between the broke organization and the evil organization. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, you know, you shouldn't want to choose either, because if you're on the euro, then all of a sudden you're draining off of Germany's economy, and Germany can only sustain so many insolvent countries before it's going to just start cutting off the goodies and go back to the Deutschmark.
I think it's personally, if I'm a Ukrainian, and granted, I didn't obviously live through the Soviet Union and their oppression and all of that,
mm-hmm.
but you can talk a lot about Vladimir Putin. Is he KGB? Does he oppress human freedom? He absolutely does. He also, in my opinion, has created an economic miracle in Russia. Russia's resurgence is incredible since he became prime minister. He's actually, his PhD was actually in studying and creating these things called super champions. It was about privatizing, when he came into power, the Russian economy, creating these nationally important corporations that would be well-run and be a pride of Russia, that created all these billionaires you hear about. And when they try to break rank, he puts them in prison. You know, he's still KGB a little bit. But Russia has a 13% flat tax. That's it.
Yeah, I heard about that on the Daily Show last night.
Yep. I thought that was hilarious, by the way. When who's the correspondent that did that?
It's not my least favorite correspondent, that's for sure.
Yeah, they're essentially saying that Russia is a conservative paradise. You know, the gays aren't allowed. They found a way to institutionalize homophobia,
which I found to be hilarious.
Oh, I thought it was fantastic. But then at the same time, they're resource wealthy. And they don't have the resource curse like a Nigeria or Venezuela.
They do have a lot of good things going for them. For one, they are part of the BRICS deal, which I think that is one reason why Ukraine might want to get in on that, because BRICS is going to be the next big thing, economic. It's going to be bigger than the IMF. It's going to be bigger than the EU. It's going to be bigger than NAFTA. I think BRICS is going to be the future.
They're going to be the new world leaders.
Yeah, they will be the new world leaders when the U.S. finally gives up the ghost economically.
Yeah, and I think that day's a long way off personally, but, you know, we'll see how it ends up.
I don't know. These countries are building steam pretty fast.
They are. China's actually, though, they're getting – that's why the stock market's freaking out. If you've been watching that at all, their debt obligations make ours look like it. Nothing.
They've got a lot more exports than we do.
Oh, they do. No doubt about that. They're just older than we are, which is scary.
They can handle a lot more debt than we can at this point.
Yeah. But, I mean, as far as Russia goes, like, for me, if I'm a Ukrainian citizen, I don't think that another Soviet Union rising is a threat. Yeah. Personally, I would not feel that. The way the world is, and Vladimir Putin is interested in making Russia an economic powerhouse, because he knows that the 800-pound gorilla in that part of the world is China.
Mm-hmm.
He knows the second 800-pound gorilla is India. They're way behind China, but they're still growing as well.
Oh, they've got a lot. They've eased a lot of their restrictions and regulations on small businesses, and they are just.
And the Russian people weren't proud after the Soviet Union fell. They didn't have that. They didn't have anything to cheer. But now they are extremely influential. They are the natural gas pipeline to all of Europe. they write their, and that's what the Syria argument's over, fight is over, is over that. And so I see as a Ukrainian citizen, I'm looking at it going, well, we're in a bad shape economically. If we take the European Union deal, we're in worse shape economically. If we take the Russian deal, it's essentially like getting your debt wiped clean.
Yeah. If we're talking just strict economics, then Russia's definitely the stronger chance. They're Ukraine's ticket into the BRICS nations.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they're going to get their energy. It's where they're going to become solvent. The problem is, though, from a civil rights perspective, they're taking a step in the wrong direction by signing either agreement.
Absolutely. But they are more culturally like the Russians than they are the Europeans.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a step in the wrong direction in either case. The anarchist in me, which makes up a great deal of percentage.
Roughly 97.6.
Probably 99.9 repeating, you know. But yeah, the anarchist in me says, no, this is a completely raw deal. You should... You know, this is the complete opposite direction you want to go. But the strict economic pragmatist in me, the Ben Bernanke that hides inside of us all.
I hope Ben Bernanke is not inside of me at any point in my life.
Oh, man. Well, the reason I originally asked that question is I just, you know, I look at kind of our national narrative and how some people are able to look at our current leadership and, you know, build kind of a vast demonization of a specific administration when it's really been a long line of practices that have been bad. And, you know, granted, they've been amplified over a certain period of time. But this guy that they currently have in charge or that, you know, they're about to oust, when Parliament for the Ukrainians, I guess, declared independence from the USSR. What was this, back in 91?
Yeah.
What did you say? Okay. So 90% of them voted for independence. But then this guy that they currently have ran back in 91, Viktor Yanukovych, and he won. But immediately after the election results came rolling in, there was this huge scandal about rigged voting. And there was accusations against him, and automatically it was corruption, right?
Yep.
So he ended up resigning. Someone else ended up winning. And it wasn't until, 2010 that this guy got back into a position of power. And I think that automatically establishes a reputation of dishonesty within this guy. And I think that in November, when he said that he was going to, I guess, agree to this EU deal that everybody seemed to want, and then when his cabinet pulled out at the last minute, it just kind of furthered that this is a dishonest leader. And at that point, I felt like everybody just, you know, the other shoe dropped and they were like, we'll do anything to get away from this guy. And I feel like that's really what catapulted them to where they're currently at with all the riots and the different things that are going on out there in Kiev.
Well, I look at this and I basically see another Egypt during the Arab Spring. They're throwing out the bums, they're angry, they're protesting, they seem to be doing all the right things, but you can tell that they quite don't understand what they're angry about.
Mm-hmm.
They know exactly that they should be angry. They have a lot of good reasons why they are angry, but they don't quite realize that the government has an adversarial role to the people fundamentally, not just in this circumstance. So throwing the bums out and replacing them is not going to do anything.
No, they really need almost a constitutional convention. They need a group of individuals that are going to come together and form, if they're going to still have the rule of law, which obviously we are libertarian, so we would argue with that from the beginning.
However, nobody's against rule of law.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. But they need to quit worrying about competing interests. Look at it from the Ukrainian. I mean, they were able to accomplish something really huge. Like, to me, that's the takeaway. Look what a group of individuals who decided they were not going to take tyranny. They met in a public park. They learned. Now, granted, they learned the tactics from a very nationalistic sect. That's why the Molotov cocktails were used.
Molotov.
Yeah, that's why they were
Molotov.
Molotov. You've never had a Jewish cocktail? L'chaim, my friend. L'chaim.
We're speaking Yiddish on this show.
Yes,
now.
I'm high. Yakshamash. If we have any Jewish listeners, I apologize for butchering that. But I mean, if I don't understand this pull to immediately go back to representatives, you already know who they are. You know what I mean? This lady's been, she's a political prisoner. She's released today. Why not sit down? You have the time. You just took the major city. Call a constitutional convention. Call a political convention. Where is that leadership instead of saying, well, let's go back to what we know and go ahead what we were going to do with anyway? I don't get that. Well, I don't understand that.
There is one big thing working against that, and that is, I mean, that is where people like us come in. People like Russia, people like China, these big countries with these very, you know, very overbearing governments, they see a country like this, and immediately their first priority is to establish continuity of government. We've seen it in Afghanistan, we've seen it in Iraq, we've seen it in Kosovo. The idea that people can govern themselves is not an idea that countries want getting out there. Like, there was a time that Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, decided to... Well, I'm getting this from a Cracked article, so forgive me if my source doesn't pan out. But
if there's someone you can rely on, it's Cracked.com.
Yeah. But I read in a Cracked article that the Republic of Georgia actually fired the entire police force due to corruption. Every single police officer, and crime went down.
Oh, yeah. I believe that completely.
But the thing is, you guess who was right there retraining their police force? The U.S. government. Because the U.S., at that point, the U.S. could say, oh, it's the crime went down because we went in right away and trained them some new security forces, and they hit the streets right away. And government's been continuous the whole time. So, you know, but the thing is, you see these things and you realize, you know, these governments are more concerned with self-preservation than they are actually serving the people.
Yeah.
And
hey, do you guys think that, because we're Americans and we build kind of an idea of every other world country in their governments. But do you think in the middle of this situation, they look at Americans and they say, well, they have a U.S. Constitution. Their leadership doesn't abide by it. These rules are broken all the time. They have corruption in their government, too, and a lot of dishonesty. And on top of that, that nation, you know, tries to police the world and establishes dominance through military bases, yada, yada, yada. And do you think they look at that and say, well, a constitutional convention won't even be on our radar because that's the end result of it?
Probably, but I hope to God that even is being talked about, and I haven't heard it in the press once.
Okay.
You know, I don't know if you guys have, but I haven't heard, why don't the Ukrainian citizens sit down and figure out what exactly Ukrainian citizens want?
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, I just think that we all know what we want in our own personal lives, and, I mean, it's just, at that point, it's just keeping the peace, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's funny, though. I see this weird trend, and every time I've looked at it, is that the course of human history is towards revolution and then the slow creep of collectivization and centralization of power. And it doesn't seem like, no matter what you do, and like the United States setup should have been the proper, legal, nonviolent way to limit centralization of power. And instead, what we have, no matter what happens, it always tends to creep that way until there's a revolutionary type event.
And so
society has to take a political laxative. Yeah. They got to kind of be cleaned out and then, you know, builds back up over time.
And actually, I've got a name for exactly what you're talking about. I call it the spontaneity problem.
The spontaneity problem.
Yeah, it seems to be something that pops up over and over again as a question to anarcho-capitalists that I have to say I don't have a complete answer for. I'm still researching. I'm still relatively new to this philosophy. I've only been in it for 3 years or so, and I don't. And the main reason I'm an anarchist is I don't buy that monopoly of force is in any way a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I don't have everything worked out in my head, but this this spontaneity problem is basically summed up as. Everywhere there's government, every square inch of soil, except for a couple bizarre administrative circumstances, are claimed by some sort of nation, some sort of government. And in groups of people that don't have government, government seems to emerge somehow. Or if it doesn't emerge, it comes from it's outsourced from somewhere. Such as with an invasion. And so people see this happening over and over again and assume that that's a natural state of things. But I feel people think of it the wrong way. I mean, human beings in the context of government have only existed with government for about 6 to 10,000 years. So before that, we had agriculture, the invention of agriculture. We've had human society for, we've had anatomically modern humans for 200,000 years. So for probably 3 to 5% of the time that we've had modern humans, we've had government. To me, government seems more like a parasite, that as soon as there was excess, there was a desire to control that excess through illegitimate means, and that as we become more mature as a society, as we become more knowledgeable as individuals and as a species, we can shrug off the parasite of government. And right now, the only reason why we still have government is government has continued to convince us that it's symbiotic rather than parasitic.
Mm. I actually had an incredible insight, I thought, to the reason government exists, and it's from the movie Tommy Boy.
I'm shocked. I like where this is going. Uh-huh.
So I don't know if you guys remember, but Tommy Boy is trying to sell this guy on carrying Callahan brake pads.
Yeah.
And the guy says there's no guarantee on the box. No, he says, and people need to see the guarantee on the box. It makes a man feel good.
Yeah.
And how do you know that the guarantee fairy isn't a crazy glue sniffer that comes in and rapes your dog? That's government. Government is the guarantee fairy that people love and need to see on the box.
Oh, but
in
fantastic.
Reality, Callahan brake pads is anarcho-capitalism that we all need.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy
that
Boy.
Is excellent.
Chris Farley, a true political theorist.
I will be using that and passing it along as my own.
Chris, Dan, will you be in the upcoming papers that you're hoping to put out at WeAreLibertarians.com, will there be one on the spontaneity problem, and will you use the Tommy Boy reference?
I will use the Tommy Boy reference. I am not asking Greg for permission. I am passing that off as my own analogy from now on.
I am glad to allow you to have that one.
No intellectual property, right, Greg?
Yep. Hey, take what you need, my friend. Take what you need.
Authorship, not ownership, right?
Greg, I wanted to ask you a follow-up question, though, before we move on to Venezuela.
I got to answer your question first.
Oh, I thought you did. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
About the spontaneity problem.
Uh-huh.
About my future papers. Right now I'm sitting down and trying to identify these major problems that that people seem to ask over and over again, so I can brand them as a generalized problem, and then I can brand a generalized solution. But so far I have what I've got written down as far as problems are concerned are the spontaneity problem, which is government emerging. You've got the rogue agent problem, where somebody is simply not cooperating with privatized courts and privatized law enforcement. You've got there's the environment problem, where what happens when minor things accumulate into large scales, and what do you do when you're talking about just things on a planetary scale versus an individualized scale? Because whether you're an environmentalist or not, we're going to start colonizing other planets, and it's not going to be that far away, and we got to start thinking about the moral implications of that now.
Aliens, man.
Aliens. I mean,
aliens.
We could always encounter aliens. I can't rule that out, you know. For those science hounds out there, you all know about the Fermi equations and the estimations and how many civilizations exist in our galaxy alone right now, while there are thousands upon millions of galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, those major problems, I don't know if I listed all of them, but we're just going to go with it for now. Just all those problems, they're, you can word those questions so simply, but they're so in-depth. So I know that they need to be addressed, and I need to figure out how to address it, but I'm afraid that if I just do one blog post on each problem, it'll be too long and nobody will read it, and I'm not going to have fun writing it. So I'm going to have to figure out, you know,
sure,
exactly how to split those up. But I really hope to have some information published on that soon in the future. But what I want to concentrate on publishing right now is how we encounter anarchism in our day-to-day lives. Like when we get in an auto accident, this is going to be the topic of my post on Monday. When we get in an auto accident, Everything is generally handled by the insurance companies. Very little of it actually makes it to our regular court system. And I think that this is a good example of private courts that people encounter in their day-to-day lives. And yeah, it's not a perfect example of a private court system, but I think it's close enough to get the point across.
Okay. All right. Well, sorry for cutting you off. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
That's fine. I just like, hey, I have a question I wanted to answer.
I thought that you used a joke to kind of deflect answering the question there for a moment, so I just went with it.
I'm not very big on deflection.
Well, that's great. You did. That's a much better answer than I was expecting to actually receive at the end of the day. But, but Greg, you were talking about Vladimir Putin,
mm-hmm.
and you were talking about how he'd actually made some sound economic policies. Mm-hmm. We're getting ready to talk about Venezuela and what's happening there and how it kind of pertains to what's happening in the rest of the world and over in Kiev and whatever. So is the perspective absolutely that he has made great economic policies? And as an economic mind, has he indeed done that? Or is it more like Hugo Chavez and what they're seeing in Venezuela right now, where he kind of rode a boom? And so people saw him as doing something positive. And now that this new leadership is in, Nicolas Maduro, who kind of looks like a Venezuelan Saddam Hussein. you know he does, right?
Yep. And guess what? He's got oil. Somebody called W. We'll go export some freedom.
Well, and so now the economy is, it's kind of gone a bust out in Venezuela. So the people in the Ukraine, can they expect that to happen if they were to join up with Russia? Or is he actually making, some real, genuine, decent economic policies that might be beneficial to them?
The nice thing about Putin is it's funny, when he comes into power, I don't know, a lot of people don't know this, he actually hired Art Laffer, which was Reagan's chief economic advisor, the guy that created the Laffer curve, which says mm-hmm. that you get the same amount of tax revenue as at 0% and 100%. Mm-hmm. And the idea is to find where you get the maximum. And so that's why Reagan cut tax rates. He said we were on the wrong side of the Laffer curve, and that's what he thought would create the economic boom.
Interesting side note about the Laffer curve. The CBO originally, from what I understand, originally came up with numbers saying that the Laffer curve would not be self-sustaining because the CBO doesn't include things like
growth.
Well, not just – well, they tend to be overly optimistic on growth, but they tend to be overly optimistic about – tax avoidance.
Yeah.
If they increase taxes on one sector of the economy, they assume that that sector is going to be just as robust.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's the funny thing, and that's kind of a sidetrack, but like, no matter what tax rates have been in America, as a percentage of GDP, it's hovered between like 16.8 and 18%, regardless of whether they were 91% or whether they were down at like 28%.
I am appalled that at one point we were at 91%.
I know. I mean, it doesn't really matter, but as far as it goes for Putin, his popularity comes from two things. It comes from that nationalism, but then his economic reforms were that flat tax. I would love a flat tax in the United States. I think a flat tax would be incredible. He has a 13%.
Taxes are theft.
They are, but this, and I agree. I totally agree, but this is one of those things where it's incrementalism. And right now, I'd take 13% flat tax rate over this
You don't need to lecture me on the virtues of incrementalism.
You work as hard as anybody, too.
I mean, I'll subscribe to incrementalism. I'm just not going to concede the idea that a flat tax would be good.
No, that's better than what we have.
It's better than what we have. I'll concede that.
Less is better than more.
Yeah, and I personally think it's the most fair, mm-hmm. in my opinion, because it's funny, Margaret Thatcher was, hugely popular, reformed England, went from a bunch of essentially an incredibly stagnant, dying society, and she turned around their economy. And
she's basically the Great Britain
Reagan.
Reagan, yeah,
she is, and she pressed, and it was she wasn't able to sell it because they're very much more a fairness people than we are. But her idea was that flat tax, because when you don't have everyone paying taxes, and like in the United States, we have what, maybe 50% paying federal income taxes. Maybe.
I think that might be a little optimistic.
Yeah, I mean, it might be more like 45% this year. When you don't have people paying for anything, for services, what do they care? There's no mm-hmm. pride of ownership. And that was her whole point. That's what was what she wanted her political messaging to be.
Well, it's not just pride of ownership. A lot of time, that's one thing that bugs me about conservatives is they always try to go the pride of ownership angle. But really, it's the tragedy of the commons. If everybody's paying per usage, then they tend to conserve their resources. But if they're not paying at all, or payments completely independent of usage, you end up with people like me who bury the needle on their internet connection all the time just because I'm using the bandwidth that the next guy down the street is paying for but not using.
Yeah. No, exactly. So that's what I really like is that Putin did it. He did it that way where there was a benefit to all Russians.
Well, the big thing about Putin, though, is, he's already won this because he's got the money.
He controls the money.
Yeah.
He has built the political upper class. He controls the Duma. He controls everything. And on top of that, he got the Olympics. And I know you guys have probably been watched a little. Vladimir Putin has been putting on one hell of a show. He's looked engaging. He's looked very cordial. I mean, whoever his PR people are should get. I mean, Barack Obama should call him immediately, or whoever runs for Republican.
It's hard to bounce
Democrat.
Back from poison water, poison tap water.
I'll tell you what, though. If anyone's done it, he's done it, because these Olympics, I mean, the woman that won the downhill slalom, I think her name was Anderson or Wagner. She was the U.S. gold medal winner. All she did was sing Russia's praises while she, as soon as she won, they asked her what she thought, and she talked about how beautiful Sochi was and what a cool country it is. And I'm just like, good Lord.
Wow.
If did you hear Jimmy Fallon
was on there, he'd be tearing them down.
Did you hear Jimmy Fallon's remark about Vladimir?
No, I didn't.
He said with the closing ceremonies of the Olympics happening Sunday, Vladimir Putin was quoted as saying, "I will be very sad to see everyone escape. I mean, go home."
You know, he's not a dictator. He's not a democratic leader by any means. But what he is responsible for a lot of Russia's resurgence, and people don't talk about that, in my opinion, economically.
Okay.
I'm not talking about politically. I'm not talking about civil rights. His research and his policies have brought them back from absolute devastation.
At least he doesn't pretend to be anybody's friend.
Yeah, and I love it that he is a capitalist dictator. I don't know if anybody else feels that way, but there's never been one of those. And like a little part of me, you know, if you've read Plato,
see your hair turning blue.
There are these philosophers. Plato always thought ideally there'd be philosopher kings that would always rule and they'd know everything. Like that's the ideal. I was kind of like, just on economics, somebody go follow Vladimir Putin and can we get like a economic free market czar in the United States?
Scrape a knife against your palm and see what color you bleed.
Yeah,
and if you believe internet memes, he wrestles bears and rides them through babbling brooks, which is cool.
I'm not saying that Rand Paul, if he runs, should get some of those memes made for himself, but it would make him look very masculine. You know, maybe an AR-15.
Canned salmon commercial way back in the day where they say that their method of getting salmon, fresh salmon, is to just run up to bears and just start beating them up and taking their salmon.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It was a hilarious commercial because you just see this guy coming in from off frame, just run up and sucker punch this this bear and then just kick him in the balls, steal his salmon.
Well, the economic practices then of Vlad and then what's going on in Venezuela are probably pretty different then from what I understand you saying.
Yeah,
Breakdown of the deteriorating economic conditions that are happening in Venezuela and why people are flooding through the streets and fighting riot police?
Yeah, so people in Venezuela are, and make no mistake, this is not a capitalist revolution. This isn't an economic revolution. This is a I need to eat revolution, and I want basic government services if I'm going to pay 75% taxes.
Yeah, and as, I mean, these revolutions are awfully, they're often half-hatched, you know, that they're often over the wrong issue but the right idea, but eventually one of these will happen where everybody's got the right idea and everybody has the right end goals, and that's going to be a game changer.
Yeah, and right now we're not there, and especially a lot of South America isn't there.
It's a law of averages, though. Eventually, it has to happen.
I feel that's a very religious argument to be making.
It's a law of averages, you know. It's just like if there's variance and there's randomness and there's a certain rate of which these things happen, eventually it happens, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I see Venezuela, and I see this. I see U.S. influence is what I see a lot of, actually. They are, I believe, the fifth largest oil exporter in the world. And I see,
jeez.
Yeah, they are not run efficiently. They're not run effectively. They nationalized the U.S.-based companies that were down there actually producing the oil, buying the oil.
Oh, wow.
Places.
So like a whole San Sebastian Lions kind of ordeal.
That, or like a lot, what it's like is a lot like Iran. Before we installed the Shah with the British government.
Are they finding out that the copper mines that were being developed didn't have ore all along?
Uh-oh. Is Francisco D'Anconia about to appear in here? I'm not going to be asked to go Galt, but I'm not going to go that Galt. I'm going to go the Galt.
Did Shell see the writing on the wall and leave only their wood-burning locomotives down there?
Exactly. That's exactly what happened.
Well, that's interesting that you draw the Iran comparison. Is that something that you could see the U.S. potentially getting involved?
We've already got our guy.
So what's going on in Iran that you're referring to specifically?
Back in 1979 when they held the Iranian hostage crisis.
They kicked out the U.S.
Yep, the Iranian people had nationalized a bit of British petroleum assets in Iran.
Okay.
That's what caused this. Is in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
British government comes in to Iran, says we will help you build out an oil and infrastructure program. We'll help you modernize and become a first world country. What ends up happening is they tip the scales towards themselves. The Iranian people don't like it at all. And the U.S. isn't involved at that point yet. And so there is a revolution then in the 50s. And it's a populist Iranian nationalist revolution. They nationalize the oil fields. They take everything under control. This really bothers the British people and the British government.
It would.
So what they do is they and the CIA coordinate a coup over the prior leader and install the Shah. And it's funny.
The British
had the major role.
Yeah, the British hadn't quite left all their imperialism behind by that point.
Yes, they were still very much creating mercantilist colonies.
Oh, okay. Trying to export their gold and oil and tears.
Yeah, and so what ended up happening, though, is that they installed the Shah. The Shah, it's funny, he made great cultural reforms. Women didn't have to wear the burqa. There were incredible civil libertarian increases. Women could go outside. Women could go to school. If you ever see pictures of Iran in the 70s, women are dressed in suits. They work. What happens, though, is they get sick of the Shah being, and this is where the parallel comes in with Venezuela. The Shah ends up flying, like he flew in his lunch daily on the Concorde from Paris.
Huh.
He lives this continental, wealthy lifestyle, and the people eventually just won't take it anymore.
Huh.
And fundamental Islam starts to spread. And so we have the Iranian Revolution, the Iranian hostage crisis, all of these different things, and they become this strict fundamentalist society. Well, right now in Venezuela, we've got our guy. We know who we like right now. He's a Harvard-educated sociologist and former mayor of Caracas, and he turned himself in as a political prisoner. He is the leader right now of the opposition to current president of Venezuela, Nicolas.
Is this Leopoldo Lopez?
That is
him. Is that who you're talking about?
Yep. He went to Harvard. He's a sociologist. Even more than that, he is a descendant of Bolivar?
Bolivar.
Yeah, Bolivar. He is a direct descendant of him. I mean, this guy, you look at him and it's like looking at a Venezuela J. Crew model.
Hmm.
Like, he's clean cut. He's got this beautiful blonde wife.
He's got the
he's
U.S.
Like a, no, he's like a Venezuelan Barack Obama.
Yeah.
He's got the U.S. connections through Harvard.
Oh, he's here. He is considered a preeminent sociologist. He's brilliant.
He's considered one of Washington's own, I imagine.
He is very much one of Washington's own.
And it makes sense because Maduro is also accusing the U.S. of engineering this unrest going on. So,
we are. And here
we never stop nation building, do we?
We never stop nation building ever. And it's not so much that we're nation building, is that they are pretty much systemically misusing their oil reserves. They're not using it effectively. They're wasting enormous amounts of capital. And because of the constriction on reply by their poor mismanagement, they are driving the price of oil up.
So they were leaning over. We just kind of nudged them with a stick, is what you're saying.
Well, it's not that. It's that they are socialism. It's like everything else. Once you run out of other people's money, it stops.
Yeah.
And so the people, the actual protesters, the signs say over and over, they speak of, they speak of Marx, they rule like Stalin, and they live like Rockefeller. And so Chavez was the same way, Maduro's the same way, the Shah of Iran was the same way. He talks about being of the people and blah 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 and making these reforms.
Sure. Gaddafi.
And yeah, because I saw this Lopez guy on TV and he was passionate.
Oh.
He was fired up. He's like, we have to take the protests in the streets. It's a moral duty, a patriotic duty.
And
if not now, then when? And it was, of course, it was all in Spanish, but like that's kind of how he was firing up the people.
It's funny. He's a populist leader because he's still very much a socialist. Venezuela, if you think it's going to turn into an economic miracle like Russia with a capitalist dictator like Putin, it didn't happen.
I've got more hope for Chile. Chile seems to be doing pretty well.
They do. That's the model. That's the model. Chile's the model, but for whatever reason, it has been resoundingly rejected in all of South America.
You've got Colombia, Venezuela, Argentina. Brazil's starting to come around.
They're trying to, but I'm telling you, I'm not qualified to talk about this, but I've read different research that says various individuals of Latin, Latin ancestry, because the community plays such a big role in their social life, in their family life, in everything, they're more communally oriented. And that transfers over into a more communal, not communist, not anything other than they care. And because they care, that transforms into more collectivist policies. And that's just some research I read, which most research is bunk anyway, but that was the first time I thought it was kind of an enlightening view of why South America and many of the Latin American countries and Central American countries are more collectivist, and there's that yearn.
I had actually heard a different idea on why North America was more technologically advanced and had better infrastructure than South America. And it's all based off of the availability of natural resources. In South America, they had a lot of natural resources, so that the countries that went there and colonized, such as Spain and Portugal, they just decided, okay, let's wholesale strip all their resources, bring it back to our homeland, and just, you know, live like kings. While in North America, there were fewer gold mines, there were fewer diamond mines, and oil was more of a future development. So the thing to make money off of the Americas, they had to do it the old-fashioned way. Build industry, build productive capacity, then tax it. And from what I understand, the reason why North America is further ahead is because we didn't have as many natural resources, we had to have more fundamentals to our economy.
The resource curse. Mm-hmm. You know, Nigeria, all of the countries across the world that end up not developing technologically, they don't put that money that they make from their resources into investment capital and those types of things. It ends up screwing them time and time again.
It's winning the lottery and squandering your winnings.
Oh, yeah. I believe in 19... I'm going to get this date wrong, but Thomas Sowell wrote about it in Basic Economics.
Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams did a lot of stuff about apartheid I've read.
They're great. I mean, I recommend everyone read their books, but what he was talking about was that there was a time when Argentina and the United States had the exact same GDP, and because of that resource curse, Argentina now today is an absolute, or they never developed like they could have, like the United States did, because of the resource curse. They ended up going the route of a more agricultural economy, of a more, not production economy, but lower down the supply chain, whereas the United States trended towards investment in innovation, those types of things.
Yeah, we started out in manufacturing, and then it became a mutualist worst nightmare where people are just buying up resources, capital goods, and leasing them out. Nobody's really working anymore.
Absolutely.
Except for the young people now.
Yeah. And Joe, what did you think of the protests?
Well, I just thought it was interesting that, you know, my wife said to me yesterday, she's like, how come none of the major news outlets are really talking too much about this? And I said, well, you know, you don't go to the major news outlets for real news. But I mean, there were these riot police. They're trying to maintain control of these crowds, and there's these Venezuelan citizens that are meeting them and they're confronting them, even though these guys have got guns and shields and helmets and everything else. And these guys are just, what, some of them are wearing motorcycle helmets and throwing these Mazel Tov cocktails, as Greg would say. And then one protester was on television, and they actually showed him saying, well, I think maybe I actually saw this online. He's like, you know, we don't have any food. There's no jobs. There's no education, no security. We don't want to live like this anymore. And so those are some pretty powerful statements. And it seems like this revolution or this situation, these riots, have gone viral on the internet. And a lot of people who wouldn't have known anything about Venezuela yesterday are all of a sudden very passionate advocates. And it makes me wonder, you know, they asked Jay Carney about their President Maduro's accusation with them engineering the unrest. And he said something like, you know, we've seen this a lot of times from this Venezuelan government, and they're trying to distract us from its own actions by blaming the U.S. and other members of the international community. So, like, I almost wonder, with him deflecting, which that's kind of what Jay Carney does, and that's his job, I guess, in this administration, but what is the U.S. really thinking? And I would love to hear what you guys think in terms of a prediction. If you could make a prediction when the U.S. might be getting involved, if they are going to get involved, or, you know, what is your feeling there?
Yeah, that's kind of complicated. The big thing is, we've seen this in the past. We've seen the U.S. government get involved in other countries and causing civil unrest in order to reach their own ends, to install their own guy into place. That's not even paranoid talking. That's part of the history book.
Right, is
our involvement in these nations. Everyone knows about the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
And right,
how that didn't even happen. And that's a matter of public record now. But the big thing is eventually. Well, the government really likes the metaphor of the boiling a frog. The biggest reason is because they think it's true. They think that they can slowly turn up the heat on a pot of water, that the frog won't notice until it's too late, and then you can cook it. So they assume that as long as they make their incremental changes, small, as long as their mission creep is slow, that nobody will notice. The problem is, people notice when they're in scalding water, no matter how long it took to get there. It doesn't matter how slowly you turn the dial. And eventually, the government's going to do something that they've done a million times before. They think it's going to work exactly like it has before, but it's going to reach a tipping point where really what they're doing is they've tipped their hand too many times. They've shown people how illegitimate they are. They've shown people how dishonest they are, and eventually people are going to realize that this is a fundamental characteristic of government and not just something we need to fix about our government.
My concern is just with the images that we're being shown and with how this is circulated online, that, you know, the American people will, because of what they're seeing and what they're hearing the people say down in Venezuela, they'll get behind some sort of intervention on our end, you know, and that's kind of why I wanted a prediction of whether or not you guys thought that would actually happen.
I think we're too war weary. We
think so.
The millennials are the ones who are making it very clear that they intend on running this country.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, I agree with you. It's just that every time I think, you know, common sense will come into play with the government, it doesn't always go that direction.
Well, the thing is, the government is not going to be the source of common sense. But the thing is, we had the government try to sell us on Syria. We had the government get the media to try to sell us on Syria. And even the most conservative of people in the U.S. were not jumping on board.
Mm-hmm.
The only people who were on board were Democratic Party
John
insiders.
McCain.
Yeah, and John McCain.
The red line's been crossed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you had the old guard Republican and the
gotta love the maverick.
And the party line Democrats who were really the only ones in support of it. And, I mean, if you don't think we're not war-weary, I mean, explain why we're not in Syria, because that had all the ingredients for intervention, and we didn't go in.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. As far as Venezuela goes, I personally feel like what's going to happen is I actually could see Russia offering safe haven to their current leader, Maduro. I think this is too much. It's got too much legs. And it's not even an issue of socialism. It's not an issue of ideology. It's an issue of basic availability of services. And even the individual that we have influenced, and he turned himself over to police, so he's currently a political prisoner, he isn't necessarily the guy. He isn't some transformative figure that's going to change them and change them and from their current adherence to more socialist policies. But what he can do is be a representative of the people and just apply basic common sense to the delivery of social services, even if it's with American influence in exchange for cheap oil, mm-hmm. which is ultimately what I think will happen. We'll help him assume power. He'll win. We'll supply the AstroTurf grassroots that are necessary to overthrow the government and help him have immediate infrastructure and ruling ability, and they'll just outsource their social services to old Uncle Sam.
You know what the original mission of Special Forces is, right?
Hmm.
It's to be a force multiplier. The idea is you're supposed to have a squad or a team of Special Forces guys parachute in the middle of nowhere, find a group of sympathizers, and train them into a manageable army.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. And that is all that Special Forces is supposed to be assigned to. That's all their mission is supposed to be. I mean, they haven't done that exact mission in a long time, but, I mean, yeah, the government does get involved in politics of other nations pretty unabashedly in this regard.
Yep. Yep.
Can we refer to Maduro as Venezuelan Saddam Hussein from here on out?
Absolutely.
I have no objection.
I have no problem with that whatsoever. And, you know, I do find it offensive, though, because you called him the Venezuelan Saddam Hussein, and you called Leopoldo Barack Obama, and they share, in fact, a name in common, and I find that racist, Joe, and I think you should apologize.
Everybody wants an apology. You want an apology? The Canadians want an apology? What is going on?
No, they want ransom. Right. They want ransom, and on the next show, we're going to actually reveal what we have to do in order to get possibly Spangle back. It's a lot like
we
got to
break.
Taken.
We got
to
break.
Well, they said in the audio though that they just wanted us to say that Canada is the greatest, and I can't say that.
Yeah, but I know that's a non-starter.
We got to figure out some way to get Spangle out of the syrup mines.
Canada has oil.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, and by the way, you know, they joked about how we are libertarians often jokes about them invading our country. Did you know that the women's and the men's Olympics Canadian hockey team beat the U.S.?
They did.
Hmm.
I think it started.
I know.
I don't know. The Canadians being better at hockey is not exactly a red flag here.
Yeah.
And well, that and won. Mixed with Spangle just all of a sudden disappearing.
I know.
The funny thing is, you know, nothing's more Canadian than hockey, but the whole NHL system is making money for Americans.
That's right. We took their best sport and made it better. That's what we always do. We
By
take the best
money
and make
off
it better. The real question, though, is did Spangle get kidnapped, or is Spangle defecting?
I don't know. Well, that's a good question. One clue is when I saw Spangle's computer sitting out open, there was a page open to Wikipedia to the various liberation movements of Canada. And it's actually interesting. I mean, our listeners at home should go look this up on Wikipedia. There are a lot of independence movements. So maybe our way to help, maybe the method we need to employ to help Spangle to contact one of these movements of rogue Canadians who would be sympathetic to our cause.
I'm sure their government would refer to them as terrorists.
Hmm? It depends. I haven't combed through all of them. Some of them might be freedom fighters.
Hey, guys.
Yeah.
Sorry. Can I talk to you about something that's happening in my work real quick?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Breaking
yeah,
news.
And I don't mean to throw you a big curveball or anything, but it just came to my mind because we're going to go into the FCC thing.
I like curveballs.
Okay. Well, I work at a conservative news talk radio station. So we're getting into this, you know, this stuff that's about to go down as far as the FCC, or I guess it won't be going down now, but the conversations that were being started about having either, you know, machines or representatives or something in radio stations and different media outlets, newsrooms to see how stories are selected. And, you know, in the report that they put out, they said it was about diversity. And they said it was about providing information on how the station serves the public interest in a variety of areas, understanding where people's biases are. And does it seem to you guys like this is maybe just a way to stop conservative ideas from going out?
Pepper, go ahead first, buddy.
I wouldn't stump you.
No, I have a lot to say.
I've got a fair amount to say too. I don't think it's anything quite that tinfoil hatty, you know? I don't think it's an attack against conservatives, because sometimes conservatives are the ones in charge in the government.
Well, maybe I'm wrong in saying conservatives. I mean anti-government ideas or
reduction
anti-Republican or Democrat ideas.
It's no secret that the government has always had an active interest in controlling the media, and that the regular media is a lot easier to control than the new media. Like, anybody can tweet, but only certain people have the money to set up a terrestrial tower and hire a staff to run it. So I think this is probably an example of trying to have a certain level of control, make sure that nothing goes out that they don't know about in advance, like at the very least from a damage control situation. Also, it looks like it's something that they're trying to monitor opinions in the aggregate by the sound of it, trying to see how their policies are soundboarding and whatnot. I mean, if you look at it from a data collection perspective, it looks like they're really trying to they see radio and traditional media as an open door that they want to close, and it also shows how outdated their mentality is. I mean, if they clench down on traditional media, it's just going to fail faster compared to new media.
Yeah. Greg, you said you had a lot to say about this. Why don't you just let it all out?
Well, let me make sure I heard your question right. Do you mind re-asking just real quick? Because I think I might have added something to yours you may have not asked.
Yeah, I think I didn't do the best job of wording it. But my curiosity was, you know, are they trying to prevent us from putting out stories that might violate or damage the narrative that they're trying to put out?
I think absolutely. I think the FCC exists solely, and I'll read this directly from Wikipedia. The FCC exists solely in order to increase six goals: the areas of broadband, competition, the spectrum, media, public safety, and homeland security. Why homeland security is important is because homeland security means the existing government. The FCC has absolutely no role other than getting to decide who gets access to the airwaves, who gets access to XYZ. All we ask is that in exchange you show the nightly news for 1 hour a night on your cable or your channel 12 or 13, NBC, ABC, CBS. You get full and free access in exchange that you devote one night to the nightly news. That is how they keep power. If you left this up to the free market in an anarcho-capitalist society, nobody would be able to broadcast unless they were the highest bidder, and there would be a variety of other ways to broadcast. They would pop up. There wouldn't just be one way, and you have to go and say, please, government, please allow me to broadcast my message to the United States. What bothers me about this, though, is that the government is going to do anything and everything they can to make sure that the message of limited government, of less government, of ineffectiveness of government doesn't hit the American people. Unfortunately, they haven't been doing a good job because of the Democratic social media, Twitter, Ben Swan. All these individuals are finding new mediums that they can't control.
Now, sure.
In Venezuela, they control the internet. That's why you have seen very little on Twitter and that type of thing. But in the United States, we're not at the point of Venezuela where it's a dictatorship and they can just flip the switch and shut down the internet. And so their concern is that a Ben Swan takes over for Brian Williams. Their concern is that a Glenn Beck gets on, you know, and takes Stephanopoulos' job on Meet the, or on this week with Glenn Beck. Because I can assure you it would not be Paul Krugman. It would probably be someone from the Mises Institute.
Well, I'd be okay with all of that.
Well, one thing we got to remember is the government seems to, the U.S. government in particular, seems to be very far behind in developing its legal code to even keep up with the level of technology. I mean, here we are in an age where people are getting their news from Twitter, Facebook, online magazines, online news reporting, you know, a lot of blogging, and they're just now getting to the point where they're bugging newsrooms. You know, that's, I mean, by the time they come up, I mean, they've been trying to get this kill switch thing put into a lot of seemingly innocuous legislation that seems to become very well known very quickly.
Because those Iranians are so dangerous to cybersecurity.
But I mean, we have SOPA and PIPA, they all had hidden clauses. And right. every time they try to bring up this kill switch idea, people find out about the legislation and people really take the streets on it. So that's one thing that I'm not particularly worried about. The other thing that makes me not particularly worried about this is as people get more and more educated educated as far as how to deal with technology, what the internet actually is, the internet spawned itself once. And in fact, it kind of originated in a lot of places at the same time. And then,
well, actually DARPA.
I mean, there's all sorts of organizations that claim ownership or creatorship of, or authorship of the internet.
Can we all agree Al Gore created it?
Right. Yeah. But I mean, the thing is, you know, there's so many people who have a legitimate claim to having a big hand in developing the internet that it's safe to say that if the government had a kill switch in place and they activated said kill switch, we'd have a different internet up and about pretty quickly.
Oh, we would.
And then at that point, as soon as the government hits that kill switch, they're, instead of killing the internet and maintaining control over us, they killed their version of the internet, and therefore they lose all their control.
Well, now they've conceded this whole thing, though, right? At least temporarily?
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, the most recent article on it is from the Wall Street Journal by Ajit Pai, and they're saying that they will send people in, and this is for more of the newsroom monitoring. They're going to send people in to go and grill reporters. How well they know things, how well they know to ask about things, and I just find this...
Wall Street Journal does not let FCC try to sneak things, things through, I've noticed. Wall Street Journal is the first one to call the FCC out.
And I mean, the thing is, though, like, let's say it passes, right? And so MSNBC is going to be like, this needs to be done. This absolutely needs to be done because we need intelligent individuals to go in and ask the people at
bullshit.
Fox hard questions.
They're going
to
use it as a barrier to entry to decrease competition.
They will. But here's the thing is the next time a Republican wins, how much are they going to love Jerry Falwell coming in and grilling a reporter on how well they know the scripture inside and out? And I'm sorry, you were found to be ill-educated, and so your segment will not make it on News Tonight because you don't know Isaiah 5:8-9.
Yeah, we are revoking your press license.
And it's one of those things. If you want to grant the power to the government, liberals, you're not always going to be in power.
Well, I mean, that's the big thing is these conservatives especially have been talking about, you know, press licenses, limiting who can have freedom of the press. And it's just like, no, I mean, the fact that we have a First Amendment should indicate that this is not a good idea. I mean, nobody's ever doubted that the people who the government find to be good reporters, we've never had to protect their ability to report.
The free market has always determined journalism, period.
Well, I mean, we've never had to defend people's rights to say good things about the internet. We've never had to defend the rights of the noble class's ability to express their opinion. We're talking about people who are anti-government. We're talking about people who say potentially dangerous things to large numbers of people. Mm. And I mean, that's exactly why the First Amendment was written, to protect those people. The fact that the prerequisite to being a member of the press was owning a press, and that was it.
Nope. Absolutely. All right.
Well,
Joe, you haven't said anything, really. I mean, I know this is something that really hits home to you. What are your exact thoughts on it?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I was kind of cutting you off there. I was having a hard time. You know, all I want things to remain free. You know, and that's not just
that's an interesting choice of words. Remain.
Well, because there's an element still to freeness. I mean, we are able to get online and make a podcast like this and put it out. I am able to work at a, you know, radio station where Glenn Beck is one of the featured, you know, shows that are out there, and it's a national program, and he can make comments that are anti-Republican, anti-Democrat. I mean, he had defund the GOP trending on Twitter last week. You know, so I just want to make sure, or be hopeful of at least the fact that to that extent, people will be able to speak their mind and create movements with their words the way that we attempt to become opinion makers here at We Are Libertarians. And I don't want any, you know, I guess, any more regulation on, you know, what's able to be put out there and what's not able to be put out there.
Okay. Okay.
So, I mean, that's really all I have in regards to this situation.
I see. Well, it's been quite the discussion. This is typically where if Lord Spangle, president of all libertarians, was around and either one, not a defector to the great white menace, or in a Saskatchewan maple syrup camp, you said, Peppers?
I said the maple syrup mines of Saskatchewan.
Okay, the maple mines.
Like, the maple syrup mines.
Is it a maple gulag, possibly?
No. Maybe a gulag. I'm picturing something like, you know, a Jurassic Park where they're just like in the middle of a mine shaft and they find a little piece of amber with a bug in it. And instead of, you know, drilling it and extracting dinosaur DNA, they just melt it down and sell it to Americans as maple syrup. That's what I'm picturing.
Are you telling me that I'm a hybrid Tyrannosaurus Rex and...
I am saying nothing of the sort.
That's quite the accusation. Well, I believe this is time to wrap up, don't you think, Joe?
Yeah, I think so. We'll go ahead and do what you guys normally do in terms of, you know, if you have anything to plug. And I would just say, guys, if you know, listeners out there, if you've made it this far into the program this time without Spangle, if you know anything about this guy's whereabouts, please send it to Twitter at We Are Libertarians, or to the Facebook page, or email us. Email addresses are all listed on the WeAreLibertarians.com website. We need to know where this guy is. So, I mean, can you lock up his apartment before you leave? How is this going to work out?
I don't know. I feel like if we lock up his apartment, he may not know where to go.
Or if we lock his apartment, he might know we were there.
That's true. And you know how he feels about involuntary errors.
Yeah, I mean, if he knows we were there, then he'll know who took all his stuff.
Well, Peppers, do you have anything to plug then before we go?
I guess if you want to follow me on Twitter, I update very infrequently. It's at Daniel Peffers. I will be announcing when my new article hits on Monday morning, hopefully, through that Twitter account, Twitter feed. And also, if you're friends with me on Facebook, I'm really not that discriminating with my friends in Facebook. So if you want to add me on Facebook, I more than likely will. Just bear in mind, with that liberal attitude of adding on people on Facebook, I might have a few cops looking in on me.
Greg, how about you?
I'll tell you what. One, first thing I'm going to do is say I don't believe that Spangle defected. Until I know the facts, I'm always suspicious. And so I do believe he was probably taken by the Canadian Taliban that is very, very prevalent within all of Saskatchewan.
For free and sovereign Nova Scotia.
Exactly. And the other one, and you know what else? Quebec wants to be, they want to secede. And
they did in the 90s.
And they're French.
But
so.
There was some sort of treaty that was signed, I found out, that...
That prevents them from seceding?
Or that stopped the whole movement. It took all the wind out of their sails once they signed it. I forget what they conceded to, but it was some constitutional amendments. It was like in 91 or 92, about the same time the Iron Curtain fell.
Okay. And Spangle, if you can hear us, just know that you are still president of all libertarians. This has not been a coup. We are just merely filling in. We are a technocrat government.
You are the libertarian
position.
John the Lionhearted.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully Greg and I and Peppers, hopefully the three of us have kind of held the reins a little bit while Spangles, wherever he's at.
Yeah, yeah. And we appreciate your questions. We received quite a few via email, and somebody's impersonating me out there. Someone created a fake greglens@gmail.com and then like and then just shredded Gina, and I was like, what? I didn't shred Gina. That's not even my Gmail address.
I don't remember saying all that.
I kind of, you know.
We Are Libertarians officially has mock accounts.
I know. Oh, man. I know. Unbelievable.
We are breaking into the industry, aren't we?
Well, guys, I just want to plug real quick the Culture and Arts podcast, The Cap, which I do host, and it's a lot of fun. It's not as in-depth or political as the We Are Libertarians podcast. It's more of just a lighthearted fun time. And I also want to post on behalf of We Are Libertarians, the upcoming Jeffrey Tucker event that we are trying to raise money to throw, which will be held on Saturday, November 15th in South Bend, Indiana. If you go to Indiegogo.com and search for We Are Libertarians Live, you will see how you can make a donation to help us raise the money to bring Jeffrey Tucker to our hometown and hold We Are Libertarians' first live event.
I do have one more thing. If any of you have questions about basic anarcho-capitalism theory or what an anarchist society would look like, feel free to throw me a question on Twitter or throw it on the We Are Libertarians Twitter, and I'll try to answer it as succinctly as I can. But bear in mind, I only have so much time to talk about this stuff, so I'm going to try to keep
Dan is the ANCAP authority.
He is president of all ANCAPs.
I mean,
you and Spangler are in the same league now.
Yeah, you can't ask Maya because Maya's a voluntarist, and apparently that's different somehow.
That's a whole.
Well, guys, we're gonna go ahead and wrap this up. We've gone like crazy over time. I know my wife's probably wondering where I'm at, and so we'll just go ahead and wrap this up the way we usually do, guys. And as always, we promise
to do better next time.